Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is a Catholic writer, husband, father of four, from Portland, Maine, Andrew McNabb. I've known Andrew for a number of years, ever since he sent me his first collection of short stories entitled The Body of This. I reviewed the short stories, and on InsideCatholic.com, I wrote this about Andrew McNabb's writing. I said, "Every now and then the real thing comes along. A Catholic writer who writes well enough to satisfy literate readers who judge fiction by the canons of fiction, not theology. You recognize him not by his profession of faith, but by his well-crafted works of fiction infused with a sacramental intelligence." Now, obviously, then, I'm a fan of Andrew McNabb, and he's coming on the show today, Church and Culture, talk a little bit about writing in general and about that book, which has recently been republished by Wise Blood Books, but also about his new book, which is being published by Divine Providence Press, entitled 8 Days. And it's really about a very fascinating and powerful experience, spiritual experience that the writer had, one that he shared with me a little bit after it happened. And we're going to talk about that book and about what Andrew does up there in Portland, Maine. Andrew, thanks for being on the show, Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale. Delighted to be here.
Now, you first published your book of short stories in what year, called The Body of This?
The Body of This was published in April of 2009.
And then you republished it recently and added 4 more stories, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Wise Blood Books. The book was first published in hardcover by Warren Machine Books, and then in June of this past year was re-released in paperback by Wise Blood Books, and it does include 4 new stories that that were written right around the time of the first release but didn't make it in, along with a critical introduction written by Katie Carl.
By the way, I'm not the only one who likes Andrew's writings. I don't want to embarrass him, but he has very highly placed fans, such as the great English writer Piers Paul Reid, who called his work exquisite, and also the American Christian fiction writer Brett Lott, who said of his short stories, "Tough little bundle of shards that can easily cut and make you bleed as it can reflect one's true light." I wish I had said that. That's perfect. And that is high praise from a very courageous Christian writer himself, Brett Lott. So I'm glad that when I actually reviewed your book, I hadn't seen any previous reviews. I'm glad I turned out not to be nuts, that I saw quality and it was there. Are you pretty happy with the reception that book has received, Andrew?
I am. You know, it's been a while now. It's been about 5 years since it was released, which is hard to believe. But yeah, I'm proud of the book. I'm proud of the book, and You know, it was, you know, a number of years in the making. And as you know, the book did pretty well and was not without its own type of controversy.
Oh, we love controversy here on Church and Culture.
Yeah, well, controversy sells. And,
well, the trouble is that, Andrew, that you're a Catholic writer talking about real human existence, whereas a lot of Catholic writers avoid whole arenas of real human existence. Why? Because they're so afraid of offending narrow-minded, puritanical readers. Is that fair?
I don't know. I can't speak for other writers.
Or readers, for that matter.
Readers. But you know, yes, I was writing from experience and from the world that I saw around me, and I like to remind others that everything that I've ever written, I've tried to just be truthful in what I have done, and to offer it up to God, and it's in my own way. And so,
well, the greatest Christian fiction writers of the 20th century, Flannery O'Connor, Walker Percy, Graham Greene, J.F. Powers, Edward O'Connor, I'm sure I'm leaving out some good ones, all of them caused the same kind of controversy that you did. In fact, whenever I recommend Flannery O'Connor to a Catholic book club, half of them get mad at me. Why are you having us read this? This just shows you how insulated a lot of Catholic readers are. Is that what you found?
Yeah, I found that there were a couple of different types of Catholic readers, and the reaction varied depending on who that reader was. And so there were people who are used to the type of Catholic writing. And let's face it, these days there's not a lot of fiction that could be classified as Catholic in any way. And so I think that the fact that my book was, you know, positioned as a reading alternative for both just regular readers of literary fiction as well as to Catholics to indulge some fiction, you know, that's where we got into a situation where some readers were expecting one thing and getting quite another. And those
because your book was called Catholic.
Because it was called Catholic, at least in a way. But you know, it's interesting because the book appealed to such a wide variety of readers, and this was a story collection. Many of the stories therein were previously published in different places. One would term, if you're in a conversation like this, as a secular literary review like the Missouri Review, and on the other hand, in Best Christian Short Stories, there's not a lot of crossover in those two different worlds. The book was reviewed here in the Portland Phoenix, which is an alternative paper where there are XXX ads on the back page, but also reviewed at Inside Catholic at Father Robert Barron's Word on Fire. And so it was a book that was unique in that it appealed to these two separate audiences. And there was a segment of those religious readers for whom they just felt that it was a little too visceral, a little too addressing topics in a way that they were unused to and felt were perhaps not befitting the sort of Catholic.
Yeah, this is the biggest problem in the whole Catholic fiction world, if there is such a world, and that is that, and I think it's true also in Christian fiction in general. If you go to a Christian bookstore and look at the kind of fiction that is being called religious fiction, same problem exists there. By calling it a Christian novel or a Catholic novel or an evangelical novel or religious novel, you've put yourself in a niche where the readership expects certain kind of things either not to be discussed or, if so, with the greatest discretion possible. And, of course, the greatest discretion possible does not necessarily make for very, very deeply penetrating, moving, or beneficial fiction. Now, do you have plans? We're going to talk about your memoir here in a second, but do you have plans for more fiction in the future, Andrew?
This is a good question, and I don't know that I can answer it just yet. I will say this, and it may make a little bit more sense after we discuss the memoir. I have attempted to impart, as a writer, I never got into writing to tell stories. I'm not a born storyteller, though my mother will say differently. She hates it when I describe myself this way, but I never got into it for that reason. I got into writing because I felt it was a calling. It was a way for me to bring to the world a certain understanding of faith and of a devout Catholic faith, and that is what I have attempted to do in every story that I've ever written. And based on my experiences, and we'll get to that in a moment, I don't know that I can impart anything fictionally again. I can't say this with certainty, but I feel like what I have experienced encompasses it all, and I cannot say it any better, deeper, or more profoundly than I did in by way of the experiences that I have had and that I wrote about. So.
Well, that's the perfect intro to move over to your book that is going to be published and is being published as we speak by Divine Providence Press, which is really a book of in two parts. The first part is a spiritual memoir, and the second part is a spiritual memoir of somewhat of your life, but particularly of 8 days in your life, which were rare. Let's put it that way. We're going to talk about that. Eight Days in Virtue is the title of the book, and it is being sold on Amazon. I looked that up. And I guess I best introduce this book to our listeners in that Andrew McNabb, ordinary Catholic guy, wife, 4 kids, struggling to make a living as a writer, all of a sudden, not really out of nowhere if you read the memoir, because you had done a lot of preparation for this, and has spiritual encounter that lasts for 8 days. So, Andrew, I know that may be a little bit difficult for you to talk about this publicly, but how would you share this with our radio audience? How would you introduce this?
Well, that's a really, really good question, and I don't know, but let's do it carefully, because this is really, my coming out, if you will, about what happened to me. Almost 3 years ago. And so I want to be respectful of what happened to me. I do know that I meant to share what happened during the course of these 8 days, and so I'm comfortable in releasing my thoughts and my experiences in the form of this memoir to the world. But at the same time, it's uncharted territory here, and I am going to take this carefully in terms of how I speak about it and how deeply I go into certain things. So, anyway, let's do this carefully.
Yeah, but let's go ahead and just get over the hump and just say what happened. I mean, you had an encounter with God, correct?
Yeah, I did. And so let me just start out then. So I, shortly after the body of this was released, I attempted for a time to continue to write short stories. Some of those stories worked, some didn't. And I felt myself being drawn in a sort of a different direction. In terms of my writing, and I had started to write an epistolary novel, the topic of which was virtue, sort of centered around virtue, specifically my being influenced by Introduction to the Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. And
which you had written a kind of commentary on over, you know, week-long retreat, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it had been a book that I had picked up because after I had found, you know, when I was new to writing, I had sought out the patron saint of writers, and I believe there may be more than one, but none greater than St. Francis of Sales. And so I had picked up his, you know, most widely read book, and it had a profound impact on me. The main topic throughout the book was virtue and employing it in our lives. And, you know, I had sort of put it down, and probably, you know, it wasn't for more than 10 years that I sort of took it up as a research type basis for writing this epistolary novel, but that novel wasn't really working, and so I the piece that I was writing turned into something quite different. It turned into really a prose poem, a book-length prose poem. I'm not a poet. I had never really tried to write poetry. It's a prose poem, so it's a sort of a combination of.
It's very Hildegard von Bingen like.
Yeah, well, thank you.
She was a medieval, you know, a medieval theologian, poet, composer, and now a saint.
Right.
That's what it reminds me most of. And of course, she wrote a poem called Ordo Virtutum, the Order of the Virtues, which she set to music.
Right, and it's fascinating. I did not know this until well after the fact. And so, in the course of writing this book, and in a first for me, and I discussed this in the memoir, I did quite a bit of research on the topic of virtue, because I'm not, I hadn't read widely about virtue, and knew I needed to get deeper and so forth. But in the course of reading, you know, various theological works and papal encyclicals, of course, the Bible itself for mention, you know, I set out to write. And what ended up happening was I produced this work. But on the morning of November 2nd, All Souls Day, as I was drawing to a close, I knew that I was getting close. I didn't know that I would be finishing the book. But I felt myself, as I was drawing to a close, sort of being led. And at the very moment that I typed the period that would end the book, I was literally, quite literally, knocked to the ground by the Holy Spirit. And it's difficult for me to find the words to describe.
Well, you struggled with that, and
yes.
But this went on for a while.
Right. So this was the beginning of these 8 days in which I was elevated to a state that I describe as sort of an in-between state. Not being fully of this earth, and certainly not fully of heaven, but having this consciousness, this awareness, this heightened spiritual sensitivity to all that was going on around me, as well as direct interaction with the individual members of the Blessed and Most Holy Trinity.
Now, Andrew, at this point we should make it clear to our audience that Andrew McNabb is not making any claims about direct revelation. He's not making any claims about himself being an authority now based upon his experience. None of that. Just telling the story of his encounter and how it affected him. Is that fair, Andrew?
That's absolutely fair. This is private revelation, a term that I was not familiar with before this ever happened.
You didn't even know about it. I love that.
certainly not. You know, and when you know, it was interesting because in doing the research for the book Virtue, I had, I had come across, the word mysticism, and I had a rough idea of what it meant, but I actually remember looking it up this summer as I was finishing up this book. And so I didn't really know what mysticism was before this happened. But
before
but,
you had it.
Well, I don't know. I mean I know what it means now. That's for sure. But yes, this is indeed, you know, private revelation. So yes.
So you're not making any claims about truth or teaching or anything like that, because we, you know, people are sensitive about these kinds of things, which they ought to be. And
sure.
So you got thrown to your knees, and you didn't get up till 8 days later. Is that correct?
Pretty much, and a lot went on in between. I will say this, that what was happening to me at times was unspeakably good, but at the same time. It was so life-altering. I wanted it to stop. I did not.
Yes, that's the impression I got as I read your book. And I was going to ask you about that. Why did you want it to stop?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One is that I was, as I said, sort of in between. I was walking around, inside of my body as I know it, as I had known it. Up until that time, but at the same time, I had this heightened awareness of all that was going on around me. Part of what was going on around me was I could sense evil. I could sense evil, whether it was lurking around me directly or is just omnipresent. I don't know for sure. I can talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But also, when I had throughout the course of these 8 days, I had ecstasies that were specific to the time in which I was going through them. So it wasn't a prolonged sort of ecstatic experience. And when I had several of these encounters, I experienced God so fully that, particularly as it related to God the Father, His power and goodness was so overwhelming that it was... I had to pull myself away, and I'll say this for fear that I might actually die. That's how powerful, a good and loving, without question, but so shattering to my very human weakness that I was terrified. And might I say terrified in a good way?
Which, by the way, is the way many mystics report their experiences like this, which puts you in very good company, by the way. And now,
right?
Have you? I mean, how have you sort of checked this out officially with the church?
Right. Well, so when this first happened to me, I had absolutely, and this is another part that was so frightening to me, is that I had absolutely no frame of reference.
Well, if you didn't know what mysticism was, et cetera, yeah, you had no frame of reference.
I didn't. I mean, I could cite a few medieval saints, but that was really it. And so it was confusing to me what was going. I knew from the very beginning that it was God Himself enacting this in my life and giving me these experiences. At the same time, it was, the emotions and the thought, it was so completely and incredibly overwhelming, physically, emotionally, spiritually draining, that it was just hard to sort of process all of it, especially not having any type of context for this to happen, especially being unable to control what was going on with me. And might I add, having to deal with my regular life, which at the time my children were even younger. I have 4 elementary school age children now. My children were younger, having having an ecstatic experience that, to set this off, and being around my children, or needing to take care of them, some wise person, this has not been shared with very many people, but a wise person said that, well, it's further proof that it's from God. God is not pulling you from your responsibilities, but urging you to, to go on in your state of life. And I've got no choice but to indulge that. So in making sense of it, in the days and the weeks and the months after this had happened, I, as you might imagine, did a lot of research. And that's where I began, trying to understand what was happening to me. And I will say, but I will not say much more, that the things continued after these 8 days to happen with me. And so I don't feel that I'm at liberty to discuss any of that. The memoir.
Well, unless it's about me personally.
Well,
okay, then we give you permission to call me and tell me. I can use all the help I can get.
Okay, well, yeah, maybe you should call me after the show. but anyway, so it was a process that took some time to sort of, and I'll never understand fully. It's just, I'm just not capable of it. But yes, and I didn't really speak to anyone about it. My, as I mentioned in the memoir, my wife, of course, immediately, and my parents.
And yes, priest.
Right, and a priest during the eight days, because I had gotten to the point where I needed some insight. I needed help, I thought, and some really remarkable things happened to me as it related to that, to my telling that priest, to events that led up to that, to my knowing to do that. It was all really incredible. And as I say, there were these divine manipulations of both, man and nature that occurred around this. So there are things, there were literally things that, it's definitely not a tease for someone to write the memo, but I just feel like I shouldn't.
No, and I'm not asking you to. I think it's enough that you've had the courage to write what you've written, which is not just two parts. I originally said two parts, but three parts. There's a prose narration of this experience over the 8 days and some background to it, which really helps to understand sort of how you maybe unconsciously prepared for what happened to you. And then a poem itself, which is entitled Virtue, which we'll talk about in a moment because we're coming up on break time. So I'm talking with Andrew McNabb about his book, 8 Days in Virtue, being published by Divine Providence Press. And we'll be back in just a moment.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
My journalistic integrity was questioned when I approached the story about 40 Days of Life and did not include what the accuser thought was a balanced view from the other side. The issue was that the other side didn't want to go on the record. See, there's a price to pay for speaking truth. But what is truth? The Bible teaches us that murder is wrong. The unborn is a person. Just read the Gospel of Luke. For behold, when the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby leaped in my womb for joy. And in Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I've appointed you a prophet to the nations. Therefore, we know it is wrong to murder the unborn. Yet, I'm still attacked for standing by the Word of God. So what would Jesus say today when the majority do not agree with me for defending Scripture? He would say, speak truth anyway. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Donhagarmo, a communication evangelist.
The annual Oktoberfest at historic St. Joseph Church next to Eastern Market in Detroit is September 27th and 28th. Authentic German food and drink, arts and crafts booths, church tours, and more. Saturday Mass will begin at 4 p.m., followed by the festival at 9 p.m., with the Killarney Creek Band and swing dancing and lessons. Sunday Mass is at 11:30 a.m., celebrated in German by Archbishop Vigneron. A 3 p.m. choral festival with regional choirs and German music and dancers. Oktoberfest ends at 7 p.m.
I'm back with Andrew McNabb, who's talking about not only his book, 8 Days in Virtue, but about the experience that he writes about in the book. And, Andrew, I'd like to come back to something you mentioned but we didn't go into, and that is part of this experience was what you felt to be the presence of evil. How did that manifest itself?
Well, it manifested itself in a couple of different ways. One is I began to sense a day or two into what was happening to me, not the state of individual souls, but I would be in a crowd of people, and I would have this profound understanding that all of these souls, not anyone specifically, but not all of these souls are destined for a good and right end. And so it was really sort of around this time that I felt a presence around me. I felt a nefarious sort of evil lurking near me. And this, of course, is terrifying because I knew that I was dealing with the spirit world. And I, again, having no frame of reference, again, being just an ordinary man and not understanding fully what was going on with me, what could happen, what might happen, when this would end, what God wanted from me in this, but at the same time, you know, experiencing Him, but at the same time sensing the evil around me. Well, you know, it was like walking around inside of a movie, but it was real. And so there was an ultimate interaction with evil towards the very end, and I'd rather not speak about that, you know, in this interview, but it was there, and then there was ultimately the interaction. So
wow, it kind of takes my breath away, but I won't push you on it, even though I'm dying to. tell us how your wife first reacted to all this.
Well, you know, my wife is wonderful. I love her dearly, and we have a tremendous relationship. And she was understanding from the very beginning, even understanding of me, maybe not of what was going on, but understanding. And this was a very important part of this. I kept saying to my wife, you know, I'm still me. I'm still me. And I kept saying that for her to know that this man that she was married to was still the man that she had married. And so, but I was saying it for myself as well, attempting to convince myself, even though I knew quite well that yes, it was me, but at the same time there was this thing that I was experiencing and going through at the time. And so if my wife had not been as understanding as she was, it would have been much more difficult, for sure. I shared everything with her from the very moment. I couldn't help not to, because at that very moment that things began, this almost horrific noise came from me, this I could hardly contain what the wind that was blowing through me, and my wife and my children, who were two floors below me in my home, came running up the stairs to see what was going on. They had never heard a sound like that, and neither have I. And my youngest daughter described it later as sort of a dying cow, which we thought was kind of funny. But, you know, she was faced with that from the very beginning, and, you know, with my making that sound, but at the same time, seeing that I was okay. And so it was something that she has a very deep faith. I'll say that my wife is Jewish. She has a very deep faith. And so she was able to understand it in her own terms. And so I think that helped her as well. But she saw what was going on with me. She witnessed it, and this, of course, helps. And of course, you know, any rational human being would go to their immediate frame of reference when faced with this type of thing. Am I going crazy? You know,
right.
You know, and I could imagine my wife thinking, you know, is he losing?
Yeah, let's get this guy on some drugs.
Right. Did something happen to him?
Right.
Did some type of switch get flipped? It was my mother's reaction initially. Chest pain. Oh, you had chest pain.
That would have been my mother's reaction for sure.
Right. And I can understand it because what I experienced is so unprecedented. And because I am who I am, we all expect anyone who was given great things by God to be someone exalted, somebody extraordinary, but so often we should know better, shouldn't we?
We should, if we've read the lives of the saints, we should know.
Yeah. Right. So there are a few, you know. Anyway, so yes, my family and my wife, you know, were very important to me at that time. At the same time, it was a very singular, personal experience what I was going through, and so I was very alone in it. And it was good, of course, having her by my side.
And your children, did they? I would imagine that children could ease into this a little more easily than adults. Am I right?
Yes. I think so. You know, just today, driving my oldest son to school, he said, "Dad, I want to read your book." And
oh, wonderful! Isn't that great?
I want him to, but I don't know that I'm ready for the questions that he'll ask. I mean, of course, he'll read the book, and all my children will. But I think so. I mean, anything can be explained away to very young children in terms of the noise from that first day, and then, you know, we sheltered the kids from what was going on during the rest of those 8 days.
You said, Andrew, at the beginning of the show, when I asked you whether or not you would write any fiction again, you said that you might discuss that impact of these 8 days on your attitude toward fiction, because you're suggesting maybe not. Maybe this is no longer what you feel called to do.
Yeah, I look at it this way, and, you know, I've always attempted to impart a message in my fiction, in my writing, should I say, and that has been fiction. But I can literally say, Neil, I can literally say now, and this is nonfiction, I have experienced God, or God has given me a tactile, bodily understanding of Him. I do not have to rely on faith alone. And I am telling my story as it relates to this. Everything that I've ever written leading up to this has in one way or another, attempted to impart that God, as we read about, exists. That
Andrew, I want to interrupt you there because I'm a kind of an amateur theologian, and you just said because of this experience, you don't have to rely on faith alone. I mean, what if I said to you, well, don't you have to have faith that experience was from God and not from somewhere else?
Well, yes, and I know that other, and I don't like to use this term in terms of myself, but other people who've had mystical experiences, they've always questioned this. Saints have questioned this, and I know that and I understand it. However, having experienced what I experienced, there's no question. There's no question. This was not a...
Well, you have the certainty of faith corroborated by experience.
Yes.
Is that a good way of putting it?
Yes, and I experienced both.
I mean, you wouldn't have had the experience without faith in the first place.
Right, and it's certainly what led me there, and this faith is not from me. Nothing that I did personally warranted what I experienced. Let's also make.
Well, you make that very clear throughout your book, and of course, I've known you now for a while, and I know that is the case. Can I play devil's advocate? I hate to use that phrase in a discussion, so, you know, different. But why would, Dante, okay, he writes about mystical experience. I don't know if his character in the poem, who goes all the way to the beatific vision, was meant to be based upon any experience Dante had. From what I know about Dante himself, I doubt it. But do you ever really get to the point where creation of beauty, creation of work that manifests and praises is something to be put away?
I don't know. Could you phrase the question differently?
Well, you're suggesting no more fiction for you.
Yeah.
And you're saying it because you've sort of seen something that makes fiction writing seem less important to you. Fair?
No. I feel like fiction is incredibly important.
Okay.
I'm reading a great novel right now. If I didn't feel like it was important, I wouldn't read it.
Okay.
I'm just saying, for me personally, it's always been my motivation to work through characters and so forth, to impart in a sort of a more subtle way. I can't be subtle in what I have.
It's the directness.
It's what I experienced was not subtle.
I see. It's the directness.
I can say, this was my initial reaction. 30 seconds into what happened to me, oh my God, it's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, it's all true. And so everything that I had believed up as a devout and faithful and practicing Catholic up to that point, I had never really questioned. I'm a cradle Catholic, a decent practicing Catholic all the way up, though, had my problems like many people, but never questioned it. But there is a big difference between having it and having that faith and then having that faith affirmed in a way that I did. And so it's all true. And what I experienced was truth itself, was God himself in his tripartite way. And so I can't do better than that. I can't do better than the experience that I was given.
Does that mean you have to write directly about that experience from henceforth?
Well, I don't know what I will write henceforth. I feel like I may be called to write about, nonfiction. I have some ideas that are going on right now, but they relate very much to my state of life. And I think one of the things that I've come to maybe understand is that, you know, for a time there was a sort of guilt associated with what I experienced because I was feeling unworthy. Of course, no one walking this earth is worthy of that. But least of all, I felt me. But at the same time, because least of all me, maybe that in itself is sort of the message. And it can be any of us. I mean, let's be clear. I've done certain things on my way to sort of prepare myself in a way for that. But there's something to be learned, I think, from who I am. I am this man. I am 46 years old. I grew up in a regular family. I went to a state university. I have four children. I coach basketball. I go to the supermarket. I do all these things. I watch, you know, TV shows. I do these things. And these things happen to me. I'm not a very holy monk who has dedicated himself to prayer and lives within the cloister walls. I'm a very real sort of human being.
You haven't decided to go live in the top of a palm tree?
Well, I don't know. I've been tempted. I've been tempted, of course, but that's not my calling in life. And I used to look at that life as, you know, behind those abbey walls as being, my goodness, how could anyone ever do it? And I have gone from that to saying, my goodness, what a blessed life to be able to live that closely to God and to be offering up every part of your day to God. And by the way, we can all do that. We can all do that, but most of us don't live that type of life.
Why do you think most people don't do that when they could? Why do you think that?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, in our modern age, people just don't really know about it, okay? I think that's, and it's not valued. You know, those people who do know about it, they feel like your life is being thrown away. What good does that do? You know, well, what are you really experiencing behind those walls? You're not out in the world. You're not seeing all of this. But for anybody who has a really true and proper understanding of life itself, we know that this life on this earth is not the end in itself. And so there's you know,
so if you were going to write a book, and I think I'm understanding now what kind of writing may lie ahead of you, for you. But if you were to write a book for people like me and other Catholics who are always looking for, how shall I say, good advice on the spiritual life or even direction on the spiritual life, what kind of advice would you give that to start making that move that you describe as living your life completely open to the presence of God?
You know, it's obviously a good question. And
well, you brought it up.
I did bring it up. You know what I answered, and I'll tell you right now, I actually addressed that in Virtue.
Okay. What page?
Well, it's from
you remember the page?
To end.
Well, from the end?
From beginning to end.
Oh, from beginning to end.
From beginning to end. It's about acknowledging who we are. How can you acknowledge who we are unless God is at your center? Okay? Because if God is not at your center, then you cannot possibly know who you are as a human being. And it's a difficult thing for people without faith. You know, you don't start in the middle. You have to sort of start at the beginning. But
He calls to us every day through the light, his light, through the light in the sky in its multi-hue, through the light in the sky where light is not just light, but countless shades that we can name or not name, because color ascends to infinity the way that numbers do, the way that space does, the way that we do. That's good poetry. Prose poem.
Right.
But it's beautifully written. And I, I've gone through, I saw this in your first version, I think you recall. And what you've got now is several steps beyond it. Let me read another passage in your prose poem. Why should we, or any of God's creatures, see? How could it be just some natural evolutionary end? Why should something without an eye develop one? Why should something without an eye develop one? This bodily component so perfect in itself, so complex and so meaningful. Meaningful. So meaningful. How is it that a bodily part can have such transcendent function? And so on. This is powerful stuff. And as I told you before, Andrew, when I first saw it, it seemed like it should be set to music.
Well, you know, maybe it will. I don't know. My fear, it's really not a fear, because that's pride, I guess. It shouldn't be fear. Is that virtue will be an afterthought, when actually virtue is more important in a way than 8 days itself, because
the prose poem itself.
The prose poem that was written, because if you're looking for a way to that ultimate end, you know, which is life in God and with God, then I've attempted to do my part as it relates to that, to be instructive in a way. And I feel like the form of the book, okay, it's a prose poem. How many people read thoughtfully, 250 or so pages of poetry? Probably not many. And so I would ask any reader, if they would ask, well, how do I read this? Well, I would say just read it rhythmically and read it. They just sort of give it time, because it's.
So read it aloud.
Read it aloud. And it's I do know some very good and prayerful people who have read it and who've been who have read it that way. And so that's the best advice I can give to that. And so, but moving forward and as to what comes next, maybe trying to write something that's more accessible in a way than that. Although I can't, from my perspective, it's an accessible piece. It's not a real difficult
piece. No, it is. No, I would agree. It is accessible if somebody has a sincere interest in it.
Right.
Which, obviously I do and many others. But let's put it this way. Someone with a sincere interest is going to really appreciate what you've written, going to be moved by it, going to want to share it with others. That's why you're here on this show, and will be again, I'm sure. And by the way, I'm sure that whatever it is you're to do, you're to write, is going to come to you. I bet money on it, even though it's not the appropriate way to put it. But I'm sure it's going to come to you.
Well, thank you, Neil.
By the way, I want to tell our listeners before our time is over that I've been talking with Andrew McNabb, Portland, Maine, Catholic writer, husband, father of four, that he's publishing a book entitled 8 Days in Virtue, which we've been talking about for most of the show, from Divine Providence Press. They have a website, divineprovidencepress.com. And also his earlier book, his book of short stories, which was republished recently by Wiseblood Press, entitled The Body of This. I strongly recommend it, as I do 8 Days in Virtue. Andrew, thanks for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dio.
And to all of you, please stay close to your radios. We'll be right back with another interesting guest.
Deacon Alex and Donna Jones shared their relationship story last year at the World Marriage Day celebration.
There came a time in my life, however, I felt I needed to get married. So I asked the Lord, "Now I want you to bring a wife into my life, and I want her to be pretty." So I went on after I prayed that prayer, and I went to Gary, Indiana, and I remember sitting in this house waiting for the prayer meeting to begin. The door opens, and in walks this gorgeous woman. But see, I was a holy man, and so I tried not to look, and so I would say that we fell in love at second sight, not love at first sight.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Pope John Paul II established World Marriage Day. Last year, we attended and recorded Deacon Alex and Donna Jones as they shared their story. Join us for Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by our day sponsor, in memory of his godly wife, Mary Sponseller. A superb homemaker and mother, she sought only to serve the Lord and raise faith-filled children as a mom in the home. Mary was a model for all young mothers to follow. Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
God's chosen people are in exile. Isaiah, that eloquent prophet, became the message of hope to encourage them, which is our first reading at Sunday's Mass. The whole of this chapter is a call to repentance and conversion. It's inviting us to think and live in a new way, according to the mind of Christ. All you who are thirsty, come to the waters, it says. You who have no money, come buy grain and eat. Seek him while he may be found. Call on him while he's near. God is near. He wants to fill us with his gifts and to stir up our desire to follow him. Now this prophecy is even truer after Jesus' death and resurrection. In Jesus' prophecy becomes true. His word is effective. The words that go forth from my mouth shall not return to me empty. Rather, they shall effect what I please and accomplish their purpose. For you shall go forth in joy and be led in peace. Jesus won joy and peace for those who trust God. He now lives in glory with the Father, and he comes to us in the Eucharist for the same reason that Isaiah prophesied to the exiles, to give us new life and new hope. A life filled with hope and trust in God's love. In the glorified Lord Jesus who comes to us at Mass, we have an even stronger foundation for confidence than those exiles did. For Christ has died, Christ has risen, and Christ will come again. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read this Sunday at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good day, I'm Al Cresta. Join me and my guests as we try to develop conversations of consequence. It's Talk Radio.